I hope you're all enjoying your lunch. It's great to see not only such a large crowd, but such a distinguished crowd. And it's especially my pleasure to start off that we're joined by a former president, not a president of the United States, but a former president of CSIS. Dick Fairbanks has a long history in Washington and Nixon White House and was President Reagan's chief Middle East negotiator. He has been the driving force behind an idea called Leyalina Productions. As we move into our discussion of addressing Arab audiences today, I want to start with Ambassador Fairbanks talking a little bit about the gist of Leyalina, the inception of Leyalina. Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, former U.S. ambassador to Morocco, is the president of Leyalina, and then we'll show you a little bit of a film of what they're doing, and we'll have a discussion with our distinguished guest, Tom Friedman. So I give you Ambassador Richard Fairbanks.
Well, thank you, John. It's a pleasure to see everyone here today, particularly a pleasure for me to have our old friend and supporter, Tom Friedman, here. I first met Tom when he was doing his first Pulitzer Prize book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, and he used to chase me around and couldn't find me. Those were the good old days. And that was also before Tom had his latest title, which is the James Patterson of nonfiction. But I think he sells more books than James Patterson. That's probably not fair. But Tom has been an absolute rock of Gibraltar in our Leyalina undertaking. We have done some 5 pilot programs of various kinds of shows. You're going to see the first one, some excerpts from the first one that's actually on the air in the Middle East. But our first 5 pilots, the first one was done by Tom Friedman in a conversation in a show we called Opinions in Arabic, Arai, or something like that, my pronunciation being horrible. And Tom and Hisham Mellem were interviewed by Mark Ginsburg for the cameras on that one. So he has been with us from the creation, and he's been a terrific supporter, and we're particularly delighted he is here today, because nobody understands, obviously, the Middle East in general and the role of public diplomacy, I think, better than does Tom. And so we're particularly happy as you could all be with us here today for that. We started Leyalina in 2002. We have been working hard to raise the funds. We're a 501c3, and we have gotten it up and running and on the air. We're now on the most watched Arab network, as you'll hear from Mark Ginsburg. And we have plans to expand now that we are on the air, up and running, and showing we can do this on the programs and on the networks that people actually watch and capturing eyeballs. So we are happy with our progress thus far. We're happy to share it with you, and we'll be even more delighted to hear from Tom shortly. Let me ask Mark Ginsburg now to say a few words about his recent trip to Dubai, where he met with our network people out there, Middle East Broadcasting, NBC, and give you an idea of what our first show is like. Mark?
Thank you. Thank you, Leader. All of us have our favorite Tom Friedman stories, it's unfair to Tom if I at least don't share one of them. That when I was ambassador in Morocco at the height of the peace process, Tom came to Morocco, and I asked him to sit in a meeting at the University of Casablanca, where we gathered a bunch of students and professors. And you can imagine that when the euphoria of the Oslo Accords at the time, the underlying current of resentment and anger that was brewing in the Arab world among even some of the youth at the time, Tom experienced it firsthand, and after we came out of that 2.5-hour brawl, he said to me, "My God, Mark, it reminded me of an Arab League meeting of 1948. And unfortunately, the cross currents of the Middle East being what they are, and what they are today, even obviously nth degrees worse than when it was when Tom and I were together in Rabat in Casablanca. Leyalina was conceptualized by Ambassador Fairbanks to essentially open up a new vista of private diplomacy in order to help break down the lines of communication and encourage and empower allies across the pond in the region and in the United States to have a much better understanding of the United States and for the United States to have a much better understanding of the Muslim world. Best way to do that, 300 million people watch television in the Arab world. on a consistent basis. And Battling the Hearts and Minds, and Tom has written so extensively about it in such enormously prosaic ways. The battle for the hearts and minds is not an American, sole American or primary principle American initiative. It is an initiative to convince Arabs, young Arabs, older Arabs, wives, children, etc., that the image that is being portrayed about the United States, putting the policies aside, is not necessarily the image that they have come should come to understand and appreciate. The images that are seen in the Arab world, and I don't know how many of you spend time in the Arab world and see the television programming that is seen, the fifth and sixth syndications and reruns of Jerry Springer, and movies that are we wouldn't even see here in the United States, and pilots and series for comedies and dramas that were rejected to not suitable for American television and purchased by Arab stations. It was time for someone to stand up and to try to, in effect, play on their home turf, and that is to develop commercial-style programming, television programming, that was not infomercial, not propaganda, certainly not U.S. government-produced, but produced for the commercial television stations of the Middle East, to go on their air, to attract their audiences, and to do so in such a way that had embedded messages in them. Think of West Wing or All in the Family, entertaining shows in and of themselves, but people thought about what they had just seen and heard. We sat down, Dick and I went out to California and sat down with 30 producers, directors, and writers and asked them and wrote down, here are the 30 reasons, at least that we can think about, why we are disliked and reviled in the Middle East. Come up with some comedy, drama, entertainment shows. And of this wonderful effort on the part of these young producers, directors, and writers, we selected 15 script treatments. And of those 15 script treatments, we decided that we would help co-produce a children's animation show, Ben and Izzy, a story about a young Arab and a young American boy, Ben and Izzy, going off on time journeys to essentially find their common roots. Ben and Izzy is being we are, in effect, one of the co-financiers of Ben and Izzy, which will be going on the air in the Middle East and also will be an educational series in the Middle East. Dick mentioned the opinion show. Hisham Melam is here, and Hisham, congratulations on your new elevation at Al Arabiya. Nice to see you. Third was the show that we will present shortly, On the Road in America. Another show that we are co-producing or producing ourselves is called How's Your Arabic? It's a comedy in which a Palestinian-American at Georgetown University, the backdrop of Georgetown University, teaching Arabic to FBI, INS, agents, Zionists, crusaders, you name it, the comedy that is derived. Again, the underlying principle of the show will be, you can accuse us Americans of a great deal. Don't accuse us of malice. Accuse us of ignorance about the Middle East. Another show, I just went out to solidify our relationship with Middle East Broadcasting Center, NBC. Don Hewitt, who is the former executive producer of 60 Minutes, and I will be working with NBC to produce Al-Sa, or The Hour in Arabic, somewhat of a takeoff in which we bring Arab and American journalists to work together on investigative journalism efforts, as well as stories about people of common interest in the United States, the Western Europe, and the Middle East. Another show that we are here to talk to you briefly about and show you a brief presentation was our breakthrough show, On the Road in America. In this show, which is now airing on NBC, 12 episodes were produced by a producer from Hollywood, Jerome Gary. It tells the story of three young Arab boys and a Palestinian woman who go on a two-month journey across the United States. It's not only a journey to open their eyes, they've never been to the United States, even though they speak English. It's a journey from which Arabs can see the American people for who they are, warts and all. They encounter all sorts of people along the way, from politicians in Washington to business leaders in New York to cowboys in Montana and so on and so on. It took us almost 4 years to achieve this breakthrough. That is, to produce a series. Dick and I, of course, are Hollywood producers, directors, and writers in our own right, and we can't wait for our Academy Award. Al Gore, you can step aside. And what is so important about this effort is it paves the way for greater private diplomacy initiatives. It is to show the United States industries, Hollywood, Madison Avenue, that you too can combine, work with the United States government, and help to secure a presence in the Middle East that hasn't been secured before. What we want to show you right now is a short 6-minute, what we call sizzle reel, that shows you a little bit about what On the Road in America is about, and afterward I'll turn the mic over to John and Tom, and they can continue their dialogue.
It's a fascinating snippet, and I think we're about to have something else fascinating going on in this room. There is nobody here who needs an introduction to our guest, Tom Friedman. He is, without question, the most influential columnist in the world today, the winner of 3 Pulitzer Prizes, and somebody who has been not only engaged with the idea of Leilina, but has been speaking for years about the need to reach out, to address Arab audiences, to deal with the problems of Arab youth, the very kinds of problems that Leilina's efforts try to address. So I am delighted to be joined here by Tom Friedman. We will have a conversation for a little while, and then we'll open it up to you, and we'll have an interactive discussion and go on for about an hour. Welcome to CSIS. It's great to see you here.
Great to be here, John. Thank you.
You know, it seems to me that Leilina is one example of a public-private partnership to reach Arab publics. How deeply do you think something like Leilina can reach? How far into these societies? And what kinds of other partnerships should we be thinking about to reach even more broadly?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for having me here. I'm crazy busy right now, but when Dick called me, I really did want to be here because I think that all hail to Dick and Mark for taking this idea, which was a gleam in their eye, I remember, and when they got Hisham and me to come and do a pilot, I had my doubts whether it would ever get off the ground. But really, you know, hats off to you guys for what you've done. I'm really glad to be here just to move this ball, you know, a little further. You know, John, I think telling our story, you know, is hugely important, and that's why I support what Leilina is doing, and telling our story in our own words. But and that I think is really necessary, but it's not sufficient, because there are two things that I think even more important than how we tell our story, and it's not to diminish that at all. One is what we do, you know, because that tells a much bigger story, how we conduct ourselves, what priorities. You know, God, we could make Leilina episodes, you know, from now until, you know, Christmas 2010. But what if we just closed Guantanamo Bay? What if we just said, we're going to take down what has become the anti-Statue of Liberty? Because we think this just no longer comports with our values. When you make a Leilina on top of that, rather than fighting with Leilina, it amplifies Leilina. And so what we do, ultimately, I'm a big believer that if you kind of got your reality right, and it's a diamond-hard reality, no amount of criticism will stick. But if you don't have your kind of hard reality right, no amount of spin will save you. Right. And so the question is sort of, what is the direction of the winds that Leilina, is it into a headwind, or is it got a huge tailwind behind us? And that tailwind is really the product of what we do. The other thing, though, I'm a huge believer in, and this gets to tailwinds and headwinds, is is the stories people tell themselves. That's also hugely important. What is the internal narrative today in the Arab Muslim world about America, about itself? I think Leolina also runs into a lot of headwinds. There are a lot of forces out there that want to depict and tell a story of America that is hostile, intemperate, I think false, but comports with the interests of various parties out there right now. And so Leolina, is it going to have an internal dialogue there that it can sail with the wind to its back or with the wind in its face? Right. So I think we have to be realistic about it. Totally necessary, but not sufficient.
Can something like Leolina reach beyond elite audiences? Should we be thinking about reaching beyond elite audiences? Or is foreign policy really what elites do, and we don't have to think that more deeply?
I think it can reach beyond elite audience. I think this is a war of ideas, ultimately. It's a struggle about ideas. And no one TV show is going to reshape public opinion. What would really reshape public opinion is if we granted 50,000 student visas. A lot more, so more young people could live Leolina, rather than treat it as almost a fantasy. Something they could never actually touch. So,
arguably we had tens of thousands of Saudi students
right here
in the United States in the 70s. It hasn't created a temperate Saudi Arabia. It's created a temperate class in Saudi Arabia,
exactly.
Which...
Well, that's where I get back to, this story of the internal narrative, which I think is... I happen to think that's the issue. So let's focus on that just for a second, because I've been writing a little bit about it of late. I cut it out, but I didn't bring it with me today. Story, should have been a front page story, but it was just a little thing on the BBC yesterday that a suicide bomber in Afghanistan showed up at the opening of a new hospital yesterday and blew himself up. Now let's stop there. We have to disaggregate that. A suicide bomber showed up at a hospital for Afghans on the first day and blew it up, blew himself and everyone around him up. I think two Americans were killed or injured. We were opening the hospital. Was there a protest from Al-Azhar? Was there a protest from the Grand Mosque in Mecca? Did the Saudi government denounce it? Did the ulama from Morocco to Indonesia denounce it? I'm a big believer that I don't believe in this counterinsurgency strategy at all, because I don't think that's what we need. I don't think that's what we're up against. This is not Malaysia in 1950. Okay, I think we're up against something much deeper and more profound, and we need a counter-nihilism strategy. We are up against complete nihilists. I had breakfast with General Eikenberry last week, our commander from Afghanistan for the last year. He gave me a statistic that shocked me. I just wasn't aware of it. That the Taliban have attacked over 200 schools. That's what they focus on. They focus on schools. So they understand it's a war of ideas. For the last two Ramadans, on the first day of Ramadan, suicide bomber in Bakuba 2 years ago walked into a mosque, a Shiite mosque, and blew it up on the first day of Ramadan in the middle of a funeral. Think of the cultural barriers you have to go through. Suicide. First day of Ramadan, in a mosque, in a funeral. Now, if I'm a big believer that the true restraints on human beings are culture, family, and religion. There aren't enough police to police us otherwise. And if those have broken down so profoundly that someone can go into a mosque on the first day of Ramadan and blow it up in the middle of a funeral, and no one says boo, and there is no million Muslim march that says no Shiites, no Sunnis, we are all, children of Islam and believers in the Prophet, then what can we do? What can we possibly do? So I'm a big believer that it takes a village. And if the village is mute, if the village can't condemn the blowing up of a hospital or the blowing up of a mosque, then there's nothing we can do. We're completely lost. There is no counterinsurgency strategy that will work. And so it seems to me the most important dialogue, this is way beyond what Leolina can do, that is missing at the political level, is that we're just not calling people on that at all. You know, we have these insipid comments, you know, about, you know, Islam is a religion of peace and all. Of course it is for 99% of Muslims. But there's a 1% that it's not a religion of peace, and that only becomes a source of restraint if the 99% call them to account. We can't do that. Muslims can't get inside my Jewish narrative. I can't get inside a Christian narrative. And Christians can't get inside a Muslim narrative. Only the village can do that. And it seems to me that where we're at right now is that the village as a collective, there are individual examples of the contrary that are truly praiseworthy. I think of the things that Hisham's boss, Abdurrahman al-Rashid, has written, incredibly courageous in the Arab press, making some of these points. But it takes a village. And if you're talking about winning the war of ideas, we can't win that. We can certainly affect, hopefully at the margin, how people think of us, but the war of ideas ultimately can only be fought by the Muslim village. And right now, the forces of moderation, which I know are the majority, I know because I have lived it, are mute.
There's also an issue of psychology. You have written several times, last year, today, actually, you wrote about the insult, humiliation, and frustration of Arab young people. How, as a country, do we address the psychology, the mass psychology of that, of individuals? And, well, and how much can you, as an outsider, affect really somebody's feeling of humiliation?
It's limited. I'm a big believer that when the world is flat, you get your humiliation fiber optically. You get it now at 100 megabits per second. Because when the world is flat, you can see just where you are and just where the caravan is and how far behind you are. And that's why I believe it isn't an accident. 9/11 happened when it happened. None of this is an accident. It's happening in the context, I believe, I'm not here to sell books. I do believe in my theory, though. It's happening in the context of a flat world, which takes humiliation and absolutely magnifies it and intensifies it, because you do get it now at 100 megabits per second. I was part of that small group of liberal hawks, and it's gotten a hell of a lot smaller.
Could fit all on the stage here.
Right, they could all comfortably fit on the stage, actually, with room for a table, who supported the Iraq War for my own reasons. And I admit that I never believed Saddam had WMD. I didn't think that was the issue. I believed in one project, and that was seeing if we could partner with Iraqis to produce the first horizontal dialogue in the modern Arab world. The Arab world, it seems to me, has known nothing but top-down monologues. Top-down monologues first from colonial powers, then from kings and dictators, often installed by colonial power. This is a part of the world, in fact, it's unique. I think it's the only part of the world that has never known a horizontal dialogue between the constituent elements of an Arab country. And I believe that's a core to the whole problem, because what we have here is what I like to call the wheel of bin Laden. It starts with kings and dictators, appointed or installed from abroad, sometimes by coup d'etat. They, in the absence of a free and fair election, empower what I would call anti-modernist religious leaders and educators who bless the regime, and the regime blesses them with financing and state title. The anti-modernists ensure that the education system remains retarded. The backward education system produces young people unprepared for modernity to realize their full aspirations and potential. That produces humiliation. The humiliation is then taken by the regimes and, like a mirror, reflected away from them onto us, onto the West, onto Israel, onto whoever, okay? And the wheel of bin Laden just goes around and around, churning out, sitting around people who are frustrated and humiliated in a flat world where they know what potential they have. I was in Syria this summer, and I was so struck. I was waiting in baggage claim. Three people on my flight came up to me and said, "Oh, you're Tom Friedman, you're here in Syria. I'm, you know, so-and-so, Syrian-American. I'm a doctor in Los Angeles. I'm a computer technician in Texas." I forgot all their skills, but it's so obvious. What these people leave their context, and they all become doctors, lawyers. Look how Arab Americans thrive in this country. So something's wrong with this wheel, okay? And it was my belief that unless you found a way to break that cycle, and you're really nowhere. We've treated the Arab world for 50 years as a collection of big, dumb gas stations. That's what we've done. And we told them three things. Very simple. We said, guys, because they were only guys. We said, guys, here's the deal. Keep your pump open, your price is low, and be nice to the Yehudis. Be nice to the Yehudis over here. And you can do whatever you want out back. You can treat your women however you want. You can deprive your people of whatever civil rights you like. Print whatever conspiracy theories in your papers you want. Teach your kids whatever you want. Preach whatever intolerance you want. No problem. Just keep the pumps open, the price low, and be nice to the Jews. It's my view that on 9/11, we got hit with the distilled essence of everything going on out back. So it was my view then, and I'm sorry, I know a lot of people would like me to apologize for my position on the war. You're going to have to wait a long time for that, okay? Because if you think I'm going to apologize for thinking that it wasn't right, necessary, and important to try to collaborate with Iraqis to try to break that wheel and build a different context of what's going on out back, you got the wrong cowboy, okay?
Let me ask you about that wheel. And about the flat world. The Economist, a few weeks ago, talked about how globalization diminishes differences between societies while it increases differences within societies. There are people who are getting ahead. There are wonderful, well-educated, worldly, cosmopolitan people in Syria. But there are a lot of people in Syria who say that's not anything I can reach to. It's not anything I can aspire to. As people on the outside, we often get comfortable with elites who don't meet the broader molds. How should we be thinking about that, especially when some of the people who aren't in our circles are people who have the same kinds of ideas about women, religion,
sure,
diversity, all those kinds of things that we find so objectionable? Should we be reaching out more? Should we be empowering those people? Or should we be continuing to work from the top with people we basically agree with but who don't have the power?
Well, you know, it's a good point, John. I go back again to this issue of context, because I have to believe the context within which people live their lives is everything. And again, let's go back to Iraq and then let's make an analogy. So what do I think we were trying to do in Iraq? And people say it's about oil. It's ridiculous. Price of oil was lower before we started than we came. We had plenty of oil before we went in to Iraq. I always said to people, oh, no. It's about something so much crazier than that. It's about, can you partner with people there to forge the first horizontal dialogue, the first social contract, where the actual constituent elements of an Arab country would actually get to write their own social contract? All right? Shiites, Kurds, Sunnis, Turkmen, you know, of Iraq, could they come together to write their own social contract? Now, this is really hard. This is really hard. We saw how hard it was in our country. So imagine after years of tyranny and colonial occupation, how difficult it would be, and abuse, you know, that they've lived through, and sanctions and war, how hard it is. But that's what we're trying to do, because if the Iraqis could forge a social contract between Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds, and other minorities in Iraq, that means democracy is possible everywhere in the Arab world. If they can't forge a social contract, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me That's a future full of kings and dictators. And if you think, as I do, that that's real, that's what it produces, that's a really bad, you know, future, I think, for the Arab people. Because I don't think they'll ever be able to realize their full potential. So let's go to those people you talked about, the ones we don't talk to. Don't come to conferences like this or Davos or anywhere. But we know they're out there.
Hey, I don't go to Davos.
We hear from them. It's I'll get you invited. You know, I always like to use the example of what's the second largest Muslim country in the world?
India.
Right. You've been reading me. You know, not
We're
Saudi Arabia.
All reading
you. Not Saudi Arabia, not Egypt. It's India. India. Well, here's a statistical anomaly. There are no Indian Muslims in Guantanamo Bay. And if there are Indian Muslims in Al-Qaeda, none have showed up that we know. I'm sure there may be, there are. We know, you know, there are extreme groups there.
Deobandi Islam comes out of India.
Right, exactly. So. But I mean, for the most part, you know, Indian Muslims have not been part of this phenomenon since 9/11. Well, that's a statistical anomaly. How could that be? Could it be because the president of India is a Muslim? Could it be because there's an Indian Muslim woman on the Indian Supreme Court? Could it be because the richest man in India today is a Muslim software entrepreneur, Azim Premji, the founder of Wipro? I mean, could it be that, you know, one of the most popular women movie stars in India is a Muslim woman? Who I actually saw debate the leading Muslim cleric of New Delhi after we invaded Afghanistan. And he called on all Indian Muslims to rise up and join the jihad against America in Afghanistan. And she told him live on Indian TV to shove it. Because she lived in a context that empowered and protected her to do so. So maybe context matters. And maybe when you give Muslims or Christians or Hindus or Jews or anybody a context where they can be the president, where they can be on the Supreme Court, where they can start a company and become the richest person in their country, where they can write an op-ed article, where they can run for office and adjudicate a legal dispute without bribing the judge with a goat. Guess what? Maybe they don't want to blow up the world. Maybe they want to be part of it. And so it seemed to me then, it seems to me now, that if you want to help those people we're not meeting, we can only do so much. But somehow we've got to find ways, short-term, long-term, war is not the answer, then what other ways, to change that context. So those people have a chance in a flat world to realize their full aspirations. Because we all have dreams. Young Arabs and Muslims as much as my girls. And when people feel, I mean, think of the self-loathing it takes to blow yourself up. I mean, think about that for a second. And then think about how many people are doing it. Well, that bespeaks a terribly poisoned context.
So let me ask a direct policy question, which is, is it your view that the position of the U.S. government should be to allow the full participation of Islamist religious parties in politics all through the region? There are a whole bunch of elections coming up. We have Moroccan elections, Jordanian elections, all sorts of elections. Should it be our position that everybody should run? You shouldn't have to be secular. You shouldn't have to forswear things. It's an open competition, so people can rise if they want to rise.
I'm not. It's a very hard question. In general, yes, provided they agree to the rules of the democratic system. You know, I don't think it's right that Hezbollah runs for office in Lebanon and then decides it's going to launch its own war. Okay.
And has a private militia.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so if you agree to all the rules of the system, which is that you disarm and you respect, you know, the rights, and you also respect the obligations that democracy is already engaged in, or if you're going to abjure those obligations, you go through a democratic process. Yes, you know, then. But I don't see that. Hamas hasn't done that. And these are essential to democracy. That you can't just come into office and say, I reject everything that a freely and fairly elected government agreed to before me. I object to it, and I'm not going to go back to the people. Okay. So I think that's why it's not a simple yes-no question. I think one thing, obviously, we've learned, you know, from the Iraq experience is that you can't, as Trotsky said, burn history. You know, there are, you know, stages, and we need to be working on all those stages. But the problem is, you know, if you look at our policy toward Egypt, you know, when we don't put the pressure on, the tendency of the regime and the system is really not to make much progress. And when we do put the pressure on, you know, there's always this sense that we're going to tip them over and you're going to end up with the Muslim Brotherhood. That's why it's got to be internally generated. And, you know, I don't know what speed it should be, but it's somewhere between 5 miles an hour and 70 miles an hour. And 5 is too slow and 70 may be too fast. But it seems to me that that's what you have to be looking for.
So looking to bring more Islamist parties into politics, even if...
No, looking for more building of the software, the institutions, right, whether among Islamist parties or secular parties, so that when they do get into office, people understand that democracy is not about what the majority wants. Right. It's about respecting the rights of the minority. Like, that's a kind of a simple thing that we take seriously. And that it's not just about elections, okay? And I'm winning, now I get to have everything.
Right.
You know, it's about respecting rules, systems, transparency, and minorities.
And it's also about people in power being willing to lose.
Absolutely, and being able to retire.
Which people in power aren't willing to do.
That's why it's not an easy question to answer.
I mean, it seems to me that the policy we had been on was a policy of working with essentially liberal elites that were comfortable with authoritarianism,
right,
because it kept the animals at bay.
Right, exactly.
And then if we start to mix with that, then you start having the issue of, can we reach out to Islamist parties? I think there's a way in which the Iraq experience has made this government more comfortable with Islamist parties, but at the same time, we have a policy toward Hamas that's absolutely no way until you leave everything at the door.
Right.
And it seems to me that as we look forward past this administration and we're trying to calibrate, how much of an emphasis should we have on democratization, liberalization?
Well, so I think
one
of
the key questions.
Right, but the answer to your question, John, I get is, I didn't mean to interrupt, but it said, I think Lebanon is the example, which is that it shouldn't be us saying, you get to be in or you not get. And what is the elected Lebanese government now saying to Hezbollah? Is that, you know, these are the rules of the game. And, you know, we'll respect them if you respect them. And the dialogue has to be internal,
right,
you know. And they've got to drive the process, not us. You know, we can help at the margins. We can make our voice and opinions heard if asked. But it seems to me that they've got to drive that the argument has got to be internally driven. That's the point I keep trying to stress.
I agree. But we also have to decide questions about who we'll talk to.
Right.
On what terms.
Yeah, I'm really, you know, have really gone back and forth on this Hamas thing. You know, my initial instinct, you know, would have been to look at this as part of a huge transition, and that if Hamas was going to fail, I didn't want it to fail because of something America did. My sort of initial instinct was to judge them much more by what they did than what they said. I have a kind of simple rule of life. I was saying this to the Israelis at the time. Never ask for a concession from the other party that even if you get it, you wouldn't believe it. So, I mean, had Hamas agreed to sing Hatikva in perfect Yiddish, okay? I mean, would anyone in Israel have believed it? Would anyone have accepted it? But if you had a year of no suicide bombing, wouldn't that have meant more to Israelis?
Right.
Wouldn't that have spoken much louder than anything Hamas had said? And so that's what I was arguing at the time. So I understand the principle, you have to accept all of these things, but what time, what context, when? We didn't appreciate they were in a transition, and I think judging them by what they did would have been a lot better in this murky transition for which there are no rules than kind of breaking out the American rule book and say, well, the rule book says now once you're in X, Y, and Z. I may be contradicting something I said before, but I'm saying each situation is situation specific.
Right.
And that's because I think Saad Din Ibrahim has been writing a lot of interesting stuff about this, and he basically says, look, you know, I mean, we liberals. You know, if I want to have a meeting outside the Ibn Khaldun Center, you know, I mean, basically my whole staff's under house arrest. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood can have a meeting 5 times a day here. Okay. It's called, you know, prayer in a mosque. And I think Saad, I don't want to speak for him, but my sense is that he's come to the conclusion that the democracy project is really going to have to be carried forward by the Islamist forces. They have the people, they have the legitimacy. And the liberals are just the people who, you know, meet with you and me here in Washington are just too small. And therefore, thinking about how we create cohorts and allies for democratization among these Muslim movements, like the Muslim Brotherhood, whatever, that are not what I distinguish from some of the more, you know, truly, they're not Al-Qaeda, I think is something we should really be giving a lot of thought to. And instead of just saying, here's the rule book, if you want to be in, you got to do X, Y, and Z, because there's a lot of very thoughtful people in these movements. We have a lot of democratic impulses, if you read what they say. And I think that we need to be giving a lot more thought to that question.
I want to ask you one last question before we open it up. And that is about the fact that you must travel with a huge distortion field. I mean, you mentioned when you go to Syria and you're sitting at baggage claim. I mean, I'm happy if nobody comes up to me at baggage claim in Syria. It can't be good news. You're recognized by three people. How, as you're traveling the world, you must be recognized everywhere. You have access to whoever you want to see. When people talk to you, they know they're having probably one of the most momentous conversations they'll have that year. How do you pierce that to find out what's really going on? How do you get outside the bubble of who you are?
Oh, that's a good question. It has, as you know, I've gotten older and you get more notorious, it is a little bit of a problem. I'll tell you, it cuts both ways. Well, when I was in Israel and I was a correspondent there, and I never forget this story. Yitzhak Rabin was then defense minister, and he was testifying before the Knesset Defense and Foreign Affairs Committee about South Lebanon. And it was about withdrawing from somewhere. I don't remember the exact context. And Rabin said, you know, if the South Lebanese don't, you know, behave according to what we want them to do, life for them will not be worth living. So I was actually listening. So this was leaked from the Defense Foreign Affairs Committee in Hebrew, you know, on the 1 o'clock news. What happened by chance that day? I was going to interview Rabin at the Defense Ministry at 5. So I was doing my own interview. So I sat down and I said, "Mr. Rabin, what exactly would life be like for South Lebanese if they don't do what you want them to do?" You know, sort of an underhand pitch. And he said, "Life for them, if they don't, you know, respect what we're saying to do, life for them will be," and then he caught himself talking to me. Not very good. Okay. Now, the difference between not very good and not worth living is being back on page 16 with the pantyhose ads and being on the front page of the New York Times, basically, you know. Right. So so that's, you know, one. So I'm keenly aware of that. So I have, my rule, you know, is that in the Middle East, what people tell you in private is irrelevant. All that matters is what they will defend in public in their own language. I say, you know, in Washington, people lie in public and tell the truth off the record. In the Middle East, it's just the opposite. People will tell you anything in private. What they will defend in public in Arabic, Hebrew, or Persian is what really matters.
But you also said...
And so I'm always listening for that, what's being said in public. Now, the other side of it, of... you know, Gail Collins, I took the editor of the editorial page once to the Middle East, and Gail came home and said, going to the Middle East with Tom Friedman is like going, like to, a, is like going to a mall with Britney Spears, because people are always coming up to me, you know, and it's a huge source of information because they are authentic voices. And one of the things that very much affected my feelings about the Iraq War before it started were the number of young people who came up to me and said, "Mr. Friedman," and they weren't calling for war, but they knew what I was talking about. "Please keep saying what you're saying, because you say what we feel but can't say." So I have lots of, you know, these are, it has downsides, but it also has upsides. You know, one of the most shocking things was I interviewed a prominent Arab leader before the war, and actually the war had already started, and people will say amazing stuff to you. Like this guy said to me, "Mr. Friedman, just understand one thing. These Shiites, they are not real Muslims." Well, that stuck in my mind also. So people will say a lot of things to me.
I spoke to a Gulf leader who said we should go ahead and bomb the hell out of Iran. So there you have it. But you also said that you shouldn't, I mean, on the one hand, you said that Israel shouldn't pay attention to what Hamas says, but what it does.
Yes.
But then there's also the issue of right, what matters is
right,
what they say.
What they say. And that's a real that's a real tension, because I know both to be true. You know, that I think sometimes when we ignore what people say, we really pay for it. And at the same time, when we obsess about what people say. Like, I was really struck reading the paper yesterday from India, Pakistan. The Indians and Pakistanis went ahead with their peace talks, despite a bomb on a train that killed 66 people that was meant to derail those peace talks. And it reminded me of what Rabin always said, we have to fight terrorism as if there's no peace talks, and we have to pursue the peace talks as if there's no terrorism. And it seems to me one trap that Israel's government since then constantly fall into is one incident, and they say, okay, we're shutting it down. Right. You know, and at some point, you just got to say, look, this is going to be going on over here, and this is going to be going on over here. We're going to pursue peace and reconciliation as if there's no terrorism, and we'll fight this over here as if there's no peace process.
It's the Ben-Gurion and the white paper and the Nazis, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's really what you got to do. And we've fallen into, I think, a lot of that, you know, trap as well.
Okay. Thank you. I hope that in the course of our conversation we've been provocative enough to arouse some questions from you. If I could just ask, do we have a roving mic, Greg? We have a roving mic for that second row. But for those of you at the table, we also have microphones. If you would just push the button and identify yourself for the benefit of everybody in the room, I would be grateful. Just you push the button down, you're good. Great.
It's working pretty good. You alluded
Charles,
to...
Charles, can you identify yourself, please?
I'm Charles Dahan. I'm the World Vice President of Moroccan Jews. You talked a lot about Iraq, but I want to come back to Hamas. You said that we should be talking to Hamas, or Israel should be talking to Hamas, or the U.S. Considering that Hamas doesn't want to recognize any past agreement from the PLO, do you still believe that that should not be a prerequisite?
Right. I mean, again, I'm full of contradictions, Charles. What I'm saying is that I think we have to understand that the whole question of the transition of these Islamist groups into democratic government is a huge transition. I would like them to make it in one leap overnight. And if I had my way, the conditions would be you have to recognize Israel, you have to renounce violence, and you have to agree to all previous conditions. That's, you know, that would be my condition. But we weren't really, there were actually two issues at stake. The issue at stake was about money. You know, whether Israel should, at the first instance, the issue was should Israel transfer these tax funds that were actually Palestinian funds back to the Palestinian Authority, now led by Hamas government. And when that was the issue on the table, my own personal view was, why not use that as a test case and simply make the test a very simple one? Will you renounce the use of force and suicide bombing? If you do, as long as you do that, then we'll transfer the money. But we're not going to pay for our own suicide, you know, for our own murder. And that could have been a very interesting bridge, maybe. Okay, you build up a little trust. We agreed to do this. They agreed to do that. Well, then maybe you start with some other thing. You don't want to agree to Oslo, but will you abide by Oslo? Okay? And you see what people do. And all I'm saying is there is a transition here that people are going to have to make. We have a huge interest in that transition. I mean, another one of the mottos I live by is, do you want to make a point or do you want to make a difference? You know, and if we want to make a point, we can make points. These are the principles. Everybody stand up, abide by the principles. You get to play, you don't. But if in the real world that's just not going to happen, then how do we work around that? That's really all I'm wrestling with. I have great respect for the other side of the argument. Why should I talk to someone, you know, who renounces all these? I understand that. But the whole point is kind of building a different process, because in the long term, we just have a huge interest at stake in seeing a movement like Hamas, which has obviously got a lot of support, a lot of legitimacy, become part of the process, not constantly fighting the process. And so you have to operate at a lot of different levels at once. This is not a debating society, and that's all I'm saying.
I just want to follow one quick thing is there is a group, a huge group in the world that believe that if peace in the Middle East, peace in Israel with the Palestinian will resolve most of the problem of the Middle East. That was the follow-up.
Do I think
are you part of that group? Is that the question?
Do I think that?
Well, yes.
I think there are a lot of problems in the Middle East. The absence of consensual government is one of them. The ability of young people to realize their full aspirations is another. And the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is another. And I think that to the extent that we take any of them off the table, we improve the prospects for others. But to think that solving the Arab-Israeli conflict will resolve the issue of young Arabs and Muslims being able to realize their full potential is ludicrous. What it might do is give a little more space for different voices to be heard. Because this is an emotional issue. It is very much part of the Arab psyche. You might think it's exaggerated. Some of us might think it's exactly the right size. All I know is the extent that you take it off the table, you create space, it seems to me, for other problems to be focused on. That's all I would put it in that perspective. I wouldn't exaggerate it. I wouldn't minimize it. It's certainly not the be-all and end-all. But it's not nothing.
Mm-hmm.
God, I could be a diplomat.
Mohammed Al-Shinawi, Voice of America. Karen Hughes said that it would take at least one generation to change the anti-American sentiment. What would you suggest to reach the Arab audiences and help improving the U.S. image, and would that, should that include some changes in the American policy?
Yeah. Well, I'm always feeling of two minds about that. I mean, on the one hand, let me just focus on one simple point. Yeah, I go back to what I said. What we do matters. How we live our lives. And I believe that you can't go to the world and say there's a war on terrorism now, and you're either with us or against us. But on that issue of a global warming, for instance, driving my Hummer. I'm not interested in your issues, And it seems to me one of the traps that this administration fell into, a self-constructed one, was that approach. I mean, one of the things that's really animated the Bush administration is anti-Clintonism. So whatever Clinton thought was important, this administration, by definition, thought was unimportant. In fact, I would say the only common denominator in this administration, which I think when the history is written will turn out to have been one of the most internally divided administrations in the history, in the modern history of the United States, divided over fundamental issues like do we want regime change or change of behavior in places like Iran, North Korea, Syria, Hamas. But there's one thing these guys all agreed on, and that is whatever Clinton did was wrong. And therefore, that led them to downplay the Arab-Israeli conflict. By definition, it had to be unimportant because Bill Clinton thought it was important. And when I come out to you, I say, look, I really need your help on this Iraq thing, but that thing you care about, even if I think your care is maybe a little exaggerated, but you do care about it. Oh, I'm sorry, that's not very important. We're not in that business anymore. We'll leave that to the third undersecretary at the embassy in Tel Aviv. That's kind of what we did. And so so one thing is acknowledging what is in, I'm a big believer, people have asked me a lot, frankly, look, I'm a little Jewish guy from Minneapolis. That's what I am. That's where I grew up. But I've operated in the Middle East for 20-some years, and I'm still here. And anyone who reads my stuff knows I'm not a shrinking violet. I tell people what I think. And but when Crown Prince Abdullah wanted to issue a peace plan, he wanted to do it through me. How'd that happen? Well, I don't know how it happened, but I have an inkling that if you ask me what is my survival strategy, I really try to be a good listener. Because, listening is not just about learning. Listening is a sign of respect. And if you actually just sit down sometimes and just listen to people, listen to what really animates them, what are their concerns, what are their passions, what are their aspirations, what do they get angry about? It's amazing what they'll then let you say to them if you just listen. Because listening is a sign of respect. It says, I do respect what you have to say. I want to disagree. I want to comment. I want to agree. But it starts with that. Now, if you listen to someone, you can really tell them anything. But if you don't listen to them, you can't tell them the sun is shining. You can't tell them the sun is shining. And you know what, right now in the Arab world, we can't tell anyone the sun is shining. That's the situation we're in. Because people can smell from 100 paces whether you're listening or not. Whether you're really listening or you're just waiting for them to stop talking. And they figured that out about the Bush administration a long time ago.
My name is George Hishmi.
George, I got a list. And it's Rafi behind you. I'm sorry.
Right behind you.
Madish.
It's okay, George. You're on the list.
Yeah, I'm Rafi Danziger from APAC. As I was watching that delightful clip, I was trying to look at it from Arab eyes. And I was thinking, if I'm a westernized, well-educated young person, I would be really taken by the film. I would think that's exactly what I want for my country. But if I am an Al-Qaeda recruiter or a Hezbollah recruiter, I would use that very film to recruit more members to my movement. I would say, look what's going on in America. Look at those women dressed so revealingly, touching each other, unrelated men and women. That kind of values are alien to us. That's precisely what the Americans are trying to bring to us. That's what we are fighting against. So how do you balance those two things?
Well, I think how you balance them is a very legitimate question, is to understand that ten set of films by Leilina isn't going to be the whole story. It takes a village, and it takes multiple messages, multiple inputs. But I go back to what I said after the film. The most important is the internal Arab narrative, what is said by them to themselves about America and about their own aspirations. And I think it's great, though, that we try to present an accurate picture of who we are. And part of who we are is a society that believes in the liberation of women. And we are an open Western society. But we also, and I think other elements of the documentary, the Leilina series show this, we're also a religious society. We have a conservative element. It's not to show America as just Britney Spears. It's to show America as Britney Spears and a whole diverse range of other cultural alternatives. That the point about America is you can choose. That no one tells you have to wear a veil. If you want to wear a veil, you can. But that you can choose. That's who we are. We're a place that you can choose. Now, they will still oppose that. They would oppose anything about America. We can't blunt that. Only Arabs and Muslims can do that with their own production. That simply says, oh, we respect your choice. Your choice to live a conservative lifestyle. But don't impose that on me. And by the way, what religion has to impose itself on another person? It should be voluntary. So there are ways to... So people ever ask me, how will you know when we've won in Iraq? Well, that's a moot question now. But my answer was always very simple. I had one answer consistently for the last 6 years. When Salman Rushdie could give a lecture in Baghdad. That's my definition of victory. Because this is a war of ideas. A war of ideas we can't win. And the only way we win in Iraq is if we've created a context where Arabs and Muslims can have a fair and equal war of ideas. And where one side doesn't get to own the playing field. That's how crazy I was.
So a lady right back there in the middle of the back row.
Thank you. Nadia Bilbisi with Al-Arabiya Television. I'm not quite sure if I understood your India analogy. I mean, India has the second largest Muslim population after Indonesia, and it's not a Muslim country.
Right.
And therefore, Muslims do well because they are a minority, and it's a typical phenomenon of a minority who do well economically and politically. Tamils in Sri Lanka, Lebanese in West Africa, Indian in East Africa, etc.
Right.
And therefore, I don't know if this is a valid argument. I mean, if you look at Turkey and Malaysia and Indonesia, three are democracies and Muslims, but we don't see the drive for recruiting extremists or terrorists to Al-Qaeda and elsewhere.
Yeah.
But don't you think that because this is not really a good example to follow, but in comparison to the Middle East, which is the major problems, is the Israeli-Palestinian question, or conflict, which is humiliating not just the Palestinians, but the Arabs and the Muslims in general.
Right.
And second, lack of democracies that allow people like Bin Laden, etc., to be recruited. So it's not exactly that.
Actually, I can see why you're confused, but actually the point I was making was really just the one you're making. all I was trying to say was that, and I could have easily talked about Turkey or Malaysia or Indonesia. I simply meant that if you, Arabs and Muslims, if you give them a democratic context, any more than if you give any other minority a democratic context, they will thrive. So to me, I was simply trying to make the democracy point. I understand what you're saying. I was just using it because it is such a large community, much bigger than Turkey, much bigger than Malaysia, that that it's about that democratic context, that that's the issue. And that Turkey, I think it applies to exactly. Malaysia, Indonesia, the same thing. So I actually agree with you, even if it didn't sound that way.
Rhonda, over here.
Hi, Rhonda Fahmy Udom International. Tom, I want to follow up on something.
What's your firm?
Fahmy Udom International.
What's that?
That's my firm.
Oh,
it's a consulting firm here in Washington. That's okay. I just wanted to follow up on something you alluded to, and it's really a pet project of mine, and I'm pitching to you in hopes that you might write about it. An extraordinary...
I love that. Just totally forward in your
You've got the pulpit. We have an extraordinary resource here in America, and that is the Arab and Muslim community.
Yeah.
Which has not been utilized, not only by the private sector, but certainly by the U.S. government. In intelligence gathering, I think now Vice Admiral Mike McConnell, the director of the National Intelligence, has now seen the light and is going to start recruiting Arab and Muslim Americans, despite some executive order that forbid first and second generation native speakers from getting security clearance backwards. So the question is, and I really congratulate all of you who are involved in this project, is, you know, whether or not the government can organize the Arab and Muslim community to help more in public diplomacy efforts. There has been a little bit of an outreach to the community, but certainly not enough in order to penetrate. And who better to serve as a bridge between the U.S. and Arab world than first and second-generation Arab Americans? We're the ones who experience growing up in this country, democracy, how a Muslim in America celebrates Christmas, how do we intermarry, mm-hmm. how do we vote, how do we participate in the political process mm-hmm. and still hang on to our identities right. and our religions. And so the question is, I guess, you know, I know you're not the government, but something to instill the U.S. government to utilize this community more, not to be afraid of them. There are people out there that do want to help. And to capture the extraordinary talents of this community.
I think it's a wonderful point. I think you've just described the next Leilina series. You know, it'd be wonderful just to have one on the life of a Christian and Muslim, Arab Muslim American. You know what I mean? Arab or Muslim American. You know, what it's like to really live here. I was so glad to see that intelligence, decision. Not just on operational, grounds, but I mean, on community grounds. So I think that it would be a wonderful, be a wonderful project, even as a one-off, or isn't part of the Leilina series. Maybe the group goes and stays as a sleepover with Arab Americans or whatever. But I think your point is really valid.
Did you follow the controversy when Charlotte Beers came out with her Muslim Life in America ads? There was an effort to uh-huh. show public service announcements,
uh-huh. oh, really?
Which portrayed Muslim life in America. Francis, how would you?
I saw some of them. I think you've got to be very careful not falling into that trap. But I think no television station in any Muslim country agreed to show it.
Huh.
I saw it on
another successful initiative. I didn't see that.
It was funny.
We can talk about it after class. There was an effort in that direction, which was not a universal success. Next person I have is Gordon, and then the woman next to you.
Thanks. Gordon Epstein, Mitsubishi Corporation. Going back to the question about Hamas, do you think there's something, or it's somehow inevitable, that Hamas will turn toward moderation, or do you think there's at least as good a chance that it means exactly what it says,
yeah,
and it'll never deviate from...
Well, it's really, trust but verify, it's really, we're weighing two things, and John's, I think, captured that duality in my own thinking. On the one hand, you really have to take seriously what people say to themselves in their own language. You ignore that at your peril. Okay. On the other hand, you have to understand that people live and operate in a context in the real world. Okay. They need to feed families. They need to create jobs. That creates pressures over here. Sometimes those pressures, can affect, ultimately, those words. And sometimes those words actually, dominate on the pressures. And seems to me the trick of diplomacy is to construct a context where you get more of what you want than the other. If you try to get it all overnight, well, that's what we tried with North Korea. And we ended up getting nothing. And when you can't make up your mind between regime change and change of behavior, you get nothing. And so what you get is people buy Bush insurance. They go and get a nuclear weapon. That's really what it is, And so
go try this at home.
Yeah, it's and so I think this is a really, and I've never written this. Talking about it right now is really very helpful, but I think if I go back, because what Saadeddin, I pay close attention to what he says. I think he's got his ear to the ground, and what he says to me feels intuitively right, that the people with the sources of legitimacy today, come out of the mosque. Some of them, do not share our values and never will. Others are much more open because they worry about this, jobs, kids, future, homes, community, in a different way. And I think we have to look at this now as a much longer-term project. How do we shape the context that we start to build, more action over here by people doing the right thing? And so one day the words catch up. But there's a real... And if you notice, the debate on this issue, which we've all been through, is this kind of the words people and the action people. So, there's the, how many times growing up did I, get the myths and facts about Israel? And it was all the words, about that Yasser Arafat had ever said about Israel. And they were all true. Okay? And yet, those of us who actually lived through Oslo, those of us who, in that sort of year, 2 years, who drove up and down the West Bank, who drove from Jerusalem to Amman in 60 minutes, who gambled at that crazy casino, whatever we did, that was also real. There were no words maybe to describe it, but that was also real. And getting those two in balance, I always find if you're just a words person, you're never going to make any progress, because to wait for the day that the words all change to the music you want to hear, that's to hostage your kids, forever. To just believe in actions also is very, very dangerous. And the subtlety of trying to move a part of the world like that really hasn't made that leap, to consensual government, to move it from A to B, really takes a very subtle diplomacy. And, I was a hitchhiker on Bush's Iraq policy, really, because that's what I want to do. But I was impatient. Maybe as I psychoanalyzed myself after 9/11, maybe too impatient, okay? Because I really wanted to see that leap happen in one place, be able to have that horizontal dialogue, because I thought that's so important. That's how you end humiliation, when you create a context where young Arabs and Muslims can realize their full potential. That's the common denominator of human beings. And I wanted it so bad, I wanted to burn history. And I recognize it may have worked. Who knows? We'll never know, because it was done so unimaginably poorly that we'll never know. Maybe in 10 years it'll all shake out. But it's sad that we haven't gotten even one good test of that. But never doubt one thing, that the people who don't want this understand how important what we're doing is, what we're trying to pull off. And that's why they're trying to kill any effort at a horizontal dialogue. That's what this is all about, okay? And look what they are doing. Blowing up 60, 70 people every day in mosques and marketplaces. And that really bespeaks people who are terrified that, my God, we might actually one day have gotten this together. Never think it wasn't important, in my view.
You right here?
Thank you, Mr. Friedman, for addressing us today. My name is Karima Daoud, and I'm working at the State Department. I think my colleague over here would be happy to hear. I'm a policy officer on Muslim outreach for Europe. And there is an increasing trend, I believe, in the government to bring on more people of Muslim and Arab descent to really maybe shed some light on this issue. Now, I watched the clip on Lealina, and I was very happy to see that such initiatives are taking place. I think we're very much interested in public diplomacy, to do the same. I know Undersecretary Hughes, for instance, just recently launched the Citizen Dialogues Tour, which has been rather successful. I encourage everyone to look that up, in which Muslim Americans have been encouraged to travel around the world to dialogue with their local counterparts. So I agree with you, Mr. Friedman, that it's very important that within the Muslim community we do have this dialogue. I think it would be phenomenal, and I've heard these comments expressed to me all throughout my trips to Pakistan and Kyrgyzstan, among other places, that there really be that dialogue that take place within the Muslim community, and that be broadcast in Lealina and other productions. I think people need to see that there's this internal debate going on where we don't have absolute consensus or agreement. At the same time, I ask you for your comments, really, on what you think about some of the criticisms that come from those same communities. A lot of them will tell you, we listen, we come, we respect you. This is why we're coming here for your exchange. We're willing to share our story, but more than anything, we're willing to hear your story. Why is it, and a Pakistani told me this on his trip, why is it when we come to when we come from Pakistan to America, we're not afforded that same level of respect? Why is it that the everyday American does not know our story? Why don't exchanges on the opposite front take place? So what role could Lealina or other productions play in really maybe shedding light on the other side, how life is in Baghdad, how life is in the Palestinian occupied territories? What do you think we could do on that front?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't want to just sort of give you an answer because I haven't thought about it, you know. I mean, I do recoil a little bit when people say we don't know their story. I mean, yes, we're a big country and everybody in the world kind of wants us to know their story at one level. But I just think of my own story. I studied Arabic and Islam at the University of Minnesota in 1975. That's where I started college. The University of Minnesota had a whole Arabic program and an Islamic center way before 9/11. And, you know, I think that I hope every American university would teach Islam or Arabic. I think it's very important for the world we live in. But you know what? Most of them do. How many American study centers are there in Saudi Arabia? How many studies of comparative religion are there in Pakistan? And so we're a big country, and I'm very hard on myself, so I want more of it here everywhere. But back there in Norwegian Minnesota, I was able to study Islam and Arabic to my heart's content, you know, in the 1970s. And I think a young Arab Muslim wanting to study comparative religion or American studies, I believe there's one program in Egypt at Cairo University that we funded. I believe Karen Hughes's shop, in fact, funds it. And other than that, you know, there's not a lot.
And we'll even allow funded centers at AUC and AUB.
Right, yeah, that's okay. So, and so I'm for more by everybody. You know, I think we need to do more. But I think that it's only going to work if they do more also on the other end. You know, and so that would be my answer, I guess.
Now it's your turn, George.
George.
Yes. Thank you, George Hashmi. I don't agree with you, Tom Friedman.
Good. You and about 7 million other people on Google.
7 to 1. Let me explain to you. It's unfair to compare what happens here that Saudi Arabia doesn't have an American Studies program there. We're dealing with two different communities, two levels of development. So that's really unfair. I'm a Palestinian by origin, grew up in Haifa, went to British schools. You know, I was never taught anything about Arab history by these schools. I was not allowed to speak Arabic during my break from schools. we were only allowed to speak English. They fooled our parents that this is the best way to learn English. Yes, they had a point, but not a good point. Addressing Arab audiences like Layalina, I've only seen 5 minutes of it, or 10 minutes. Who do you address in the Arab world? Do you address the westernized Arab youth of Beirut and Cairo and what else? I don't know what else. Or do you address the people at large? And of course, we go back to the bottom line. Actions speak louder than words. You and I as journalists don't like that statement. But it's a fact. So we have to look at what the U.S. government has tried to do. They closed the U.S. Information Agency, where I worked for many years, and headed the Arabic department in the information business. But then they started Al-Hurra and Radio Sawa. By any measure, they're flops, with all respect to my former colleagues. So addressing the Arab world is not just saying the right things or showing them how America is doing things. We have to go and see what is the problem in the Arab world. I think Condoleezza Rice made a wonderful statement at the American University in Cairo. Stability versus democracy. I thought that was a fantastic lecture. The U.S. government is interested in stability, not democracy. Look at the American University of Beirut, where I graduated. I'm surprised and shocked I was when I was started working in the Beirut Daily Star, which I used to edit in the 60s. They said, no petroleum engineering was taught at American University. We always was wondering about that. There's no journalism school. Why don't American companies that invest in the Middle East advertise in the local papers? Hey, you and I know, without advertising, we cannot survive. These are issues where U.S. government, U.S. businesses, U.S. journalists, U.S. educators, institutions like this have to address. Don't just address the westernized Arab youth in Layalina. That's my question.
You're just echoing some of the things that I've been saying, though. Actions matter more, and there are multiple audiences. But I wouldn't be hard on Layalina. You have to start somewhere. Yes. And I think this is a start. And I know if they get the resources, they're going to address multiple audiences. But you have to start somewhere, it seems to me.
Well, the point, George, is that everyone understands the importance of addressing the hardest of audiences. The key here is that the programming is going to be directed at different audiences, but we need the resources to make that happen.
Two very quick questions. There's one from the lady in black there, and then the woman at the corner, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
I was just going to say I work in Karen Hughes' office as well, and that the Citizen Dialogue Program is a very exciting program to take Muslim Americans from the U.S. overseas to dialogue with people over there. We'd just love to have your call.
Okay.
Good. I'd be happy to do it.
Excellent. Good. And
great question.
Let me just say something on that. I know about that program, Rhonda. But it hasn't been written about. So
okay. Woman right here is the last word.
My question for you, my name is Sherry Daniels. I'm a State Department Foreign Service officer on loan for a year to Senator Lieberman's office as a fellow. And I speak for myself. I don't know what Senator Lieberman whether he would ask the question. But my question for you was, in your comments about how to deal with, about Saad Eddine's comments in Egypt and about the people in the Arab world that have legitimacy, would be the religious conservative religious movement, not even just moderate religious. Does that mean that the path to democracy is through religious, pseudo-religious democracies that may or may not guarantee rights for minorities? Or do you believe the Muslim Brotherhood could be convinced to adapt to allowing moderate, non-religious lifestyle alongside its own?
Well, again, you know, that's a very legitimate question, and there's no cookie-cutter answer. What have we learned from Iraq? We learned from Iraq is when you crack the palace in any of these countries right now, you go straight to the mosque. The elevator just goes straight down to the mosque. There is no civil society institution in between to slow that fall. So if that's the reality, if under the core of stability we've supported regimes that basically have stripped or prevented any civil society institutions of real integrity, real labor unions, real free press, real women's associations. You can go right down the list. Then you got to work with what you've got. It would be nice to do otherwise, but you have to work with what you've got. And I don't see any other way. Let's keep Iraq out of it. Let's just say Iraq doesn't exist, but you were starting now, and you believed in this, project. What would you do? I think it'd be this very subtle, nurturing of civil society institutions in all the different countries, at many different levels. Some Egypt's farther ahead, maybe, than Jordan or Saudi Arabia or whatever. But why do I focus so much on the price of oil? Because I'm a big believer that people don't change when you tell them they should. They change when they tell themselves they must. And the motto of our revolution was no taxation without representation, the Boston Tea Party. And the motto of the petrostate is no representation without taxation. That if I don't have to tax you, I don't have to represent you. And as long as you have that bargain at the core, where I can get all the resources I need to run my state by tapping an oil well rather than tapping people, it's very hard to build civil society institutions, okay, in the context where the leadership, which controls all the assets, has no interest or compulsion to actually cede any power to create a legitimate civil society institution because they can rule their people without taxing their people. So money matters, and that's why I focus on that.
I want to thank you all for coming. I want to thank the leadership of Leilina for coming and talking to us, showing us what you're doing. And most of all, I want to thank Tom Friedman. You have lived up to your reputation as being a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Really enjoyed it.